Hey everybody, it's Mike. Welcome or welcome back to the Revision Church Podcast. While you're here, make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and download the Revision app, which is actually the best way to get access to new content and share it with friends. You can get the app by texting Revision app to 77977. Thanks for listening today. My hope is that this message will be helpful for you and would inspire you to take the next step on your faith journey.
Amen. You guys can take a seat. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision. I'm excited to be here this morning. How about you? All right. So I want to kick things off with an audience participation moment, just by a show of hands. Is anyone else just doing amazing at marriage right now? Nobody, just me? I've been nailing it for like a decade and a half, and I can say that confidently up here because Jenny's in Revision Kids. So we were actually talking and laughing the other day about how marriage is good and beautiful, but also really hard because it's two people trying to forge one path in the same direction, and I'm still so bad at it, but I used to be even worse. Our twins just turned 7, which is crazy to me, but on their 7th birthday, we were remembering the day that they were born and telling them the story, and then we were thinking back to when Jimmy and Emma were born, and I was reminded of one of my not greatest moments. Like when Jenny was in labor with Jimmy, her first time, like our first go-round of this, we got to the hospital, she got hooked up to all the stuff, and she was understandably a little bit nervous. Allegedly, she was in some pain. It's impossible to know, but that's what she said anyway. But all I could think for the first hour that we were in there was, it's so cold, I'm freezing. And my head was like, dude, just get over it, suck it up and deal. Your wife needs you to focus on her right now, and marriage is about self-sacrifice, and you're not that cold. But my gut kept saying, you know what, Mike? I think you'd actually be more helpful. Really, it'd be a huge benefit to her if you weren't thinking about how cold you were. You should probably leave and go get a sweatshirt. And we lived like half an hour away from this hospital, but there was a mall next door. So eventually, my gut won out over what my head knew was probably the better decision. And I looked at this woman who was in labor for the very first time and said, hey, that nurse said it's probably going to be a while, and I am just chilly. So I'm going to run over to that mall and grab a sweatshirt. And I left her laying there. And that was the day I learned not to trust my gut. You can't be doing that. And Jenny was actually super cool about the whole thing, but it was, and it remains, a really good reminder for me that my feelings in any given moment are not always the best metric for making wise decisions. It's one of those moments that I'll never live down. But it's hard not to lean into our feelings. I think it's difficult for all of us not to just go with our gut and let our emotions determine our direction, especially when life is tough. When we're facing challenges that we've never faced before, we begin to worry and we start to play that what-if game in our minds. Like, what if the political tensions in our country keep growing? What if inflation skyrockets? What if things never get back to normal? What if that fractured relationship never heals? What if somebody I love gets sick? What if I don't get the grades? What if I don't make that team? What if my kids make bad decisions? What if I have to be cold the entire time my wife is in labor? What if? Or like, what if I'm single forever? Or what if I'm not single, but I marry the wrong person? Then what if I have the wrong kids? That would be weird. Or what if I marry the right person when you have the right kids, but I'm in the wrong job, but I have to stay in that job because the kid needs braces? And if the kids don't get braces, they'll marry the wrong person. Then I'll have the wrong grandkids, and that's going to be an awkward conversation when they're 5, and I'm like, you're not the grandkid I was expecting. Don't pretend like you don't do that stuff. We all do, and it toys with our emotions. And here's the deal. In this messed up world, when we filter our decisions through our feelings, it can rob us of our future. This morning we're in week 2 of this series called Your Future Self. And the big idea of this series is to get a little bit of wisdom before we need it, so that when we need it, our future selves will thank us for having it. I saw a post on social media a couple weeks ago that said, life is a series of tests. You just have to hope you pass. And I thought, I do not agree with either of those sentences. Like, first of all, if anything, life is a series of pop quizzes. With tests, you know exactly when they're coming and exactly what they're going to be about. But that's not how life works at all. Most of the difficult things we face in this shattered space we occupy happen at random. They pop up We don't know when they're coming. We don't know what they're going to be about, but they happen to us. And when they do, we are either prepared to make wise decisions or we're not. And so in this series, we're going to grab hold of a little bit of the wisdom God has for us so that our future selves aren't crippled by making decisions based on our feelings and our emotions, which are unreliable when things go poorly. And specifically this morning, I want to talk about the grid we use to make decisions when life is hard. So if you have a Bible or a Bible handy, you can crack it open to the book of Proverbs, chapter 3. Proverbs is easy to find. It's sandwiched between Psalms and Song of Solomon, almost right in the middle. If you don't have a Bible, you can follow along in the Revision app or with the words up on the screen. And if you need a Bible or your kids do, please grab one from the Next Steps table or let us know on your digital connection card and we will mail you one. They're free and we love it when they disappear. But Proverbs, written by Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived. And in chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, he writes something incredibly profound. And for all the churchy people in here, it'll be real familiar. Like if you grew up in or around church, your mom probably had this on a coffee mug and your grandma had it on one of those cross-stitch things hanging on the wall. But if that's you, don't let your familiarity with this passage blind you to the fact that what Solomon says here is powerful and important. In verses 5 and 6, he says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to him, and he will make your paths straight." I love this so much because it highlights both the great paradox of the book of Proverbs and the great problem of the life of Mike. Like throughout the book of Proverbs, Solomon keeps hammering home this idea that wise people understand how foolish they really are. Part of what makes wise people wise is that they know there's a lot they don't know. They have a keen grasp of the limits of their intellect and their abilities. But foolish people think they're wise. Foolish people are the ones who think, "Oh, I know everything. I know everything there is to know. I can do this all on my own. I don't need anybody else's help. I can navigate life by my own wisdom and my own power." And in Proverbs 3, Solomon says, "No, you can't do it. If you want to overcome all the obstacles that are up in front of you, the only way to do it is God's way. He's the God of full valleys and flat mountains and straight curves and level bumps. He's the one who can make your paths straight." And so Solomon goes, here's the big idea that will make your life better and will make you better at life. When you're making decisions, go with your God, not your gut. All right, life is difficult. And challenges are going to pop up around every corner. If it's not difficult right now, it will be again soon. But if your future self isn't prepared to go with your God, not your gut, you're going to make unwise decisions. You'll always lean the wrong way until you learn to trust what God promises more than what you feel. If you lean into your feelings, they will rob you of your future. But if I can be real and raw and honest with you guys for a minute, as I look back at the course of my life, I think especially as I look back at the course of the last year, trying to lead through this pandemic, trying to walk into the unknown that all of us have walked toward as the world changed beneath our feet in an instant, I see so many instances where I leaned on my own understanding rather than God's, where I thought, "Man, I got this. I have the wisdom, I have the intelligence, I have the strength to just navigate this situation." And I went with my gut and my feelings about what was the best decision rather than humbly coming to God and allowing him to lead the way. Because honestly, sometimes I feel like my way is better than God's way. I know where he's leading, I know what he thinks, but I'm like, you're wrong. You know, like I'm pretty sure that my plan is a better plan than your plan. And then I look back at this series of failures and crooked paths I walked trying to do it my own way and realize that was a mistake. But I bet I'm not the only one who made it. Like I'd be willing to bet that me and Frank Sinatra are not the only two people who could tell the story of when I did it my way. It's just destructive. It hurts us and it hurts everyone around us when we decide to take the reins. But the truth is, as humans, it's almost impossible not to end up in that place.
especially when life is hard. Because when we face situations that are difficult, emotions flood up in our souls. And they tend to try to grab control and lead us in their direction rather than God's. It's a struggle. It's a struggle because I think in those moments, we are particularly susceptible to two specific temptations. And they're not new. They're old. They're ancient. They've been true for human beings since the very beginning of time. And Genesis 6 talks about these two temptations. This is what it says. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were smoking hot, and they married any of them they chose. And then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever. They are mortal. I'm going to give them 120 years to turn this thing around. And the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. It's fun, huh? Some of you are looking at me like, that's a weird passage, Mike. First of all, what does it mean? And second of all, what in the world does it have to do with the stuff that you were just talking about? And I want to affirm you, that's a weird passage. Some people, when they're studying the book of Genesis, just skip over these verses. And there's a lot of debate, like way too much of it historically, about what this passage is talking about. Like, there's these theologians that get together, because it seems like it says that the sons of God was this one group that married the daughters of men, and then they had these Nephilim, and the Nephilim were an ancient race of giants. So then God had to send a flood to wipe out the giant hybrid babies. Is that what happened? And I know you guys love it when I make my own drawings to help you understand the Bible. I always get good feedback from that. So I have a number of drawings for you today. After this, the art prints will be available on my website just as soon as Jeff makes me a website. Do you think we make mikesartsermons.com? That's where it'll be. But like, here we go. You ready for this? All right, this is the prevailing theories about what's happening in Genesis 6. So there's these women, all right? And they're looking good and stuff. Like, there they are. And they're marrying the sons of God. But who are the sons of God? Well, some people are like, it's angels. Angels were like, looked at how good the human women were looking. They're like, I'm going to marry them up. And then they had these babies that were giant babies. Or maybe they weren't giant babies, but they grew into giants. And people are like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But other people are like, no, it can't be that. Could it be angels? Because God seems pretty grumpy about this whole thing. He's going to flood the earth. Could it be angels? Fallen angels, demon babies, demons and women got together. Demon babies are powerful and junk. And then there's this other set of intellectuals, and you'll find them on the History Channel. I'm not kidding. And they're like, no, you idiots. Angels are incorporeal. They don't have bodies. Clearly, this is talking about ancient aliens getting together with women and making alien babies. This is what happened. And that's what people think is happening in Genesis 6. And those of you who've been around revision for any length of time can guess which one of those I find to be the most compelling. The alien one, of course. I'm just kidding. It's none of those, all right? This is an odd little section of the Bible at first glance. But if we dig in, what we find is, number one, it's not actually that weird. And number two, it's describing these twin temptations that have been a reality for human beings since the beginning of time that cause us to rely on our own understanding rather than trusting God completely. And they cause us to do that, especially when things feel bad, which makes this passage super relevant for us today, because I think it's easy to look around at the hatred and the injustice and the racism and the division and the frustration and the economy and the increasingly pagan culture we're surrounded by and think, wow, things are bad. I don't know if things have ever been this bad before. And this passage is a reminder that things have been bad before. And not just this bad, but way worse. It was actually written specifically to be a reminder of that for the people of Israel.
See, Genesis was written by Moses to the nation of Israel about 400 years after they had escaped from 400 years of slavery in Egypt. They wandered through the desert and they got to the cusp of this land that God had promised them. But when they entered into that land, they were going to face some very real and very specific temptations. And so God wrote this stuff down because he knew that their hearts would be inclined away from him toward themselves. And so he wanted to warn them. Because if we read through the book of Genesis and read through the entire Old Testament, we see these same obstacles again and again and again and again tripping up the nation of Israel. So God's like, hey, before you go in, before you cross the Jordan River into this promised land, you should know what's going to happen. And real pragmatically, it seems that one of the greatest problems the nation of Israel is going to face is that when they enter into the promised land, the women who are already living there are really, really good looking. Like so good looking, in fact, that the men of Israel are going to be tempted to abandon God and chase after their pagan deities in order to connect with them. And that's like what God says. It's like, hey, look, this is what's maybe gonna happen, and guess what? It happened before. It happened before, and it didn't just break my heart, it broke the world. That's what Genesis 6 is talking about. See, when it says the sons of God saw the daughters of men and married any of them they chose, that phrase is not talking about angels or demons or aliens or any other sort of celestial beings. When Moses says sons of God, he's talking about God's people, men, women, and children, this faithful remnant who knew God, loved God, and were following after him. And when he uses the phrase daughters of men, he's talking about all the people who didn't know God. So the contrast he's drawing here is between people who know God and don't know God. And he's saying, look, way back in the day, you guys, people who knew God followed their eyes and their feelings and their guts more than their faith, and they chased after people who didn't know him at all. They gave up on him in order to gain people who didn't know him. And it was destructive. It was destructive when they chased their feelings. You see, God's plan from the very beginning was that people who knew him and loved him would marry other people who loved him, and they would raise up children that loved him and knew his love and shared it with the world. That was his design from the start. And when humanity stepped away from his design, disaster occurred. But that's what happens when we put our desires above God's design. And that's the first temptation that every single one of us faces when life is hard. We are tempted to put our desires above God's design. It happens. And the results are devastating. We see it in Genesis 6. God looked out at this broken world that was shattered, that was full of pain and suffering because humanity decided to go their own way. And he said, look, I'm not contending with humans forever. I won't do it. I can't do it. And the word for contend there is wrestle. It means like struggle for control, which is interesting because since the very beginning, that's what's been happening. Since Adam and Eve decided in the garden that what they wanted was probably a better choice than what God said was best, humans have been struggling with God for control. They did it first, and we've all followed suit. We've said, God, thank you for life and all that stuff, but I got it from here. I'll just take control because I think I probably know better about my life than you do. And when we do that, we don't just hurt ourselves. We end up hurting everything and everyone around us. We know that. We've lived it. I've lived it. And in the middle of that, God still is loving and God still is kind. And so he says, look, I'm going to give them a long grace period. I'm going to give humanity 120 years to figure out what Carrie Underwood has been trying to tell them, that they should just let Jesus take the wheel. He's a better driver than you. Let him drive. But God says, if they can't do it, if they won't do it, if there's nobody left to light up the darkness, if there's no people left on earth who are living into the design, into the way that they were wired and knit together and created to live, then it's so bad. There's so much pain, so much hurt, so much suffering that's going to happen that there has to be a hard reset. I love these people I created in my image too much to just sit back and watch, and I cannot do it. But you guys, that's what happens It happened before, it happened again, and it will happen again if we place our desires above God's designs. But we got to realize it's an ancient temptation. It's not going away anytime soon, so we should be aware of it. And the second old school temptation Moses highlights for the people of Israel is they're about to enter into this promised land, which is full of big, scary people they'll have to fight in order to take the land. This is the second temptation that's very relevant for us in the middle of our challenges today is this: when life is difficult, we're tempted to trust human strength instead of God's sovereignty. It's really easy to look at the people around us, particularly those in power, and come to the conclusion that they have more control over our future than God does. And when we do that, we end up living with this constant sense of fear and anxiety because we've pinned our hopes to created people rather than the Creator. But this is what's happening in Genesis 6 with the Nephilim. What we find when we dig in is this fascinating picture God is painting for us of what happens when we trust in human power rather than His omnipotence. In verse 4, it says, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown." Okay, a couple things real quick. Number one, it does not say in this passage anywhere that the Nephilim were the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men. It just says, like, while God's people were chasing after all these beautiful people that didn't know God, the Nephilim were there also. Beforehand, while it was happening, and afterwards. So simple reading comprehension could save a lot of theology nerds a whole lot of time debating stupid theories about alien demon spawn babies. It just doesn't say that. Number two, why is there one random Hebrew word smack dab in the middle of all the English words that we weren't too lazy to leave untranslated? Like, why does it still say Nephilim? That's a great question, and the answer is Nephilim is kind of a complicated concept that's hard to translate. On the surface, it means giants. It referred to this ancient race of giants, and not mythical giants, but a fully human race of people that were just real big. It's like what we say when we see Shaq next to a normal human. Like, that dude's a giant. Or we see football players, like, giant. That is a giant human being. This is a giant. This is a Nephilim, right? So it means giants, but we don't simply translate it giants because it's also this term that God used to describe these big, powerful guys, ironically, in a mocking way. Like, God used the word Nephilim to make fun of not the big, giant Nephilim, but all the people who were just in awe of them because they were so big and powerful. Like, if you break down the Hebrew, it means the fallen ones. So Genesis 6:4 says, in the olden days, they thought the fallen ones were heroes. Like, that's what God is saying. It's God's way of looking at us, at people back then, and at you and me, and saying, really? That's who you put your trust in? You pinned your hope to them because they look big, and they look strong, and they seem powerful. That's where you thought your future was going to be, like, safe? You thought they were going to provide for you just because they have power? You got real nervous and you typed all over social media and you rushed to the polls to vote and nervously watched the election results because you think your hope is tied up in powerful men? These ones that are fallen and dead, not eternal? You trust more in the strength of these finite beings than you do in the sovereignty of the infinite? Huh. Well, that's a disastrous, anxiety-ridden, fear-filled way to live. They may look like giants in the world of human beings, but compared to their creator, their power is nothing. Stop putting your faith in fake heroes. That's why God calls them the Nephilim. They're giant compared to us, but they're nothing compared to Him, and that's why the word Nephilim gets left in there. But I'll be straight. If you guys are anything like me, it's easy to be in awe of human strength. It's easy to look at powerful men and women and believe that they have a whole lot of control over my future, maybe even more than God. It's easy, especially when things are tough and scary and the future looks murky, to trust in human power and in human intellect and in human systems instead of the God who sits enthroned above all of that. Here's the deal. When life is hard, and life is frequently hard, you will be tempted to put your desires above God's design. And you will be tempted to trust in human strength instead of God's sovereignty. But I promise you, your future self will thank you if you decide that you're going to lean not on your own understanding, but you're going to trust in the Lord with all your heart. If you decide that in all your ways, in every single thing you do, you're going to submit to him, your future self will thank you because he will make your paths straight. He'll shelter you from the storm that's raging around you. It's interesting, the word that Solomon uses here for trust, when he says trust in the Lord with all your heart, is this Hebrew word betach. Can everybody say betach with me? Betach. It's fun to say. It sounds like you're going to hawk a loogie. But anyways, betach is this word that means find shelter. Know that you're safe. It's crazy to me because like that is your reality. That's my reality. In the midst of a crazy, scary, shattered world, we can find shelter and know that we're safe when we decide to go with our God, not our God. But let's be clear. In order to get there, you have to leave where you are. You got to move from the comfort of the space you currently occupy if you're going to walk into the space of security God has for you. You got to surrender self-determination if you're going to seize the safety. And this morning, I just want to invite you to do that. I want to invite you to grab hold of that little bit of wisdom your future self will thank you for getting. And I want you to pre-decide today that when life gets rough, when temptation hits, when things are scary, you're not going to be the idiot who abandons your pregnant wife in labor to go get a sweatshirt because you decided that your feelings are a good guide for making decisions. You're not going to put your desires above God's design. You're not going to trust human strength rather than his sovereignty. You're not going to walk this dangerous, destructive, failed path of believing that you know better than God. But instead, you're going to go with your God, not your gut. Pre-decide that's how you're going to live. Because if you do, you'll realize he really does keep his promises. You'll find serious peace and straight paths. Will you guys pray with me? Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for being a God who didn't just abandon us when we abandon you. Every single one of us has decided that we know better than you in some way, shape, or form. We put our desires above your design and chased after the things of this world and hurt ourselves and the people around us. And we just thank you for not abandoning us to that space or leaving us to our brokenness. And I pray, God, that as we move forward, as we leave here today, we would be a people that are able to shine a light in the darkness of our world by trusting in you with our whole hearts, by not leaning on our own understandings, but rather submitting to the design that you have and the plans that you have so that we can be all that you created us to be, so that we can seize the lives and the futures you have for us, so that we can write a better story for our world. Thank you for allowing us to be a part of that. In Jesus' name, amen.